From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for Halloween weekend 2022. Just a reminder, a lot of kids will be out trick-or-treating this weekend, so let's be careful out there. Now back to our regular scheduled program. The Packers play the Bills, one of the hottest teams in the NFL, Sunday night in Buffalo. That could be very scary. Your undefeated Milwaukee Bucks have four games at home this week, and that'll be fun. And the World Series starts tonight. Remember the Washington Commanders who beat the Packers last Sunday? Well, they run a 50-50 raffle just like every pro team does. There's just one difference. When it came time to pay off the winner, the $14,000 check bounced. And yet we still lost to that team. Apparently I'm not over it. Our headline of the week, rats with backpacks. Man, that's creepy. Okay, rats with backpacks can help rescue earthquake survivors. I think that headline comes to us from the Rats Public Relations firm. I ran across this list of things baby boomers still do. And at the risk of embarrassing them and their kids, here we go. With apologies to Jeff Foxworthy. If you still use AOL, get catalogs by mail, eat spam, buy gender toys like pink and blue, you might be a boomer. If you have fine china and get Reader's Digest and still have a landline, you might be a boomer. I don't have a landline, but my wife does, but she's older than I am. If you love chain restaurants, wear Crocs and New Balance shoes because they're wide, you might be a boomer. If you watch 24-hour news channels, have metal detectors, knickknacks, tchotchkes, and use personal email while everybody is texting, you might be a boomer. And lastly, you might be a boomer if you had, and maybe still have, patterned textured wallpaper. If you throw in the Beatles, we're the last great generation. Until the next one. On the podcast today, we have Art Rothschild, Tom Pfaffenfuss, Joel Driesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, not that there's anything wrong with any of those things, Max. I just want to clarify that this isn't a statement of any kind of judgment on those.
How many boxes could you check?
More than I'm willing to admit, unfortunately.
You're hiding your New Balances right now.
Yeah. Plenty to laugh about this week. Market's up pretty substantially. The NASDAQ up 2.2%, closing at 11,102. The S&P 500 up 4% this week, closing at 3901, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 5.7% this week, up 828 points on Friday, closing at the bell at 32861 for the year. Dow now down just 8.1%, the S&P down 17.1%, the NASDAQ still far, far behind, down 28.6%. A quick look at the markets this week, obviously, I think, points to, Art, what has been a really strong October, despite the fact that mid-month we were reaching new lows for the year. In the span of just a couple of weeks now, we're back up, you know, for the month now, looking at north of 8%. Still a trading day left to go, but I think on pace for what's going to be a pretty strong month and some stuff for maybe investors to be pretty excited about. It seems like markets have maybe calmed down a little for now, even if there's some more stuff we need to keep our eyes on.
Yeah, Kyle, it's a little spooky given the month. October is known for some significant declines. We only have to get through one more trading day. And if we do, it's going to be the best month for the Dow since January of 1976, was something I saw in today's Wall Street Journal. It's neat that it's the Dow that I'm talking about there. Even though the NASDAQ, as you pointed out, had a good week being up 2%, the Dow was up more than twice that. And as you pointed out also, the loss for the year for the Dow is single digits, 8.1%. Again, 20% less than the NASDAQ. The NASDAQ stocks this week, it took a hit. Some of them did. It wasn't only earnings. It was things they said about what they expect in the future for some of them. Apple was an exception, doing relatively well this week. So the lesson for investors is, don't just rest on your laurels from the past decade. I think this may be a time at which, given the drubbing we've all taken in our portfolios of any kind of stocks, it's a good time to look at your portfolios perhaps for tax loss selling. get rid of some of that old stuff, get some new stuff, and the new stuff might be the old stuff, as Max was alluding to. Some of these stodgy old companies that might do at least give you a smoother ride without as many, you know, thrill spills and excitement. So that's my early message for today.
Maybe not the wallpaper manufacturers, but some of those other old names may be exciting. Yeah. You know, Tom, I think an important lesson the past couple of weeks is just how much of a penalty investors get for being on the sidelines in what can turn pretty quickly. We get this question often about, well, why shouldn't we time the market? It's obvious that things are going to fall apart. Well, you go back to some of the bottoms in the middle of the month, not all that much has changed, and yet all of a sudden a pretty significant run higher, missing just a couple of those days for investors might be a pretty big deal for their long-term total return.
Yeah, honestly, I found myself quoting, and I'm going to loosely cite it, but I think the study was over the last 30 years, just being out or missing the two best returning days in any given year, looking at the last 30 years, has eroded as much as 10% on average in a given year. So it's needless to say, you don't want to be out those 2 days. And usually those two best days naturally may be on the heels or on the backs of a really terrible day. So it really goes to show you that, you know, if you play that game, you're really putting yourself at risk for missing some of those year's best returns. And, you know, we've seen it firsthand. I also tell people that, you know, when you're looking at investments and types of either mutual fund or exchange-traded fund investing, you know, they track not only the performance of that fund itself and the components of it, but they actually track what the average investor return is in it. As you might guess, it is naturally a pretty big difference. The investor, we are naturally more emotional people, and we will tend to underperform. We'll react at different times, buy in when it looks good and get out when it looks bad. And so, yeah, again, just kind of emphasizing that point, Kyle, that you'll miss out a lot if you kind of play that game.
Yeah, Morningstar, a big backer of some of that research into investor return versus the actual return of investments. And I think it speaks to exactly what you're saying, that so many investors do the absolute wrong thing. They respond to the emotion. They respond to these natural instincts of fear and greed, right? That you chase the thing that's made the most money. You run from the thing that's lost the most. And of course, you know, at most points in time, that's the absolute wrong thing to do. If something sold off a bunch, unless there's a really clear reason why it sold off a bunch, and there's plenty of those out there, it's usually a pretty good time to buy. And we're seeing a lot of those opportunities in the market right now.
Yeah, I think, you know, as you kind of hinted at it, Art, when we're, you know, it's been a big earnings week. You know, I think we talked about, you know, Apple had a really good week with what they announced and beating their earnings estimates. But conversely, a number of the big names being hurt, I think Microsoft, Google, Meta, Amazon, I mean, just some of the biggest of the big names out there. And so I find it really interesting, and I think it highlights a really good point that, you know, that the market, the S&P, the NASDAQ, they were up on the week given those two heavy hitters missing so far, you know, with their earnings estimates. And so it just really goes to show you that I think in this environment, this climate, it's going to be really important that you pay attention to what you own within that. Just blindly owning some of these index that are market cap weighted with heavy exposures to these, you might not outperform the way you used to from years past.
Yeah, it's also important to note what the catalyst was this week, which really was speculation again as to what the Fed's going to be doing. Until pretty much this week, most investors thought that the Fed was going to raise rates 0.75% in November and 0.75% in December. So the mere suggestion that it's only going to be 0.5% in December, and that may, you know, usher in this new era of gentleness on the part of the Fed in continuing to raise interest rates, did cause the stock market to rally. In short, I think that was the catalyst. And I think we have to be careful, because the last time this happened in July, we had a nice rally, just to have it squashed by the Fed, you know, with Chairman Powell reminding us about pain that's going to be inflicted. And with positive numbers for GDP, which I'm assuming Joel's going to be talking about, yeah, you got to talk about this, Joel. Now you got to talk about it. But you know, it's, again, not a time for levity, as we were discussing earlier. Take a look at your portfolios. Be careful out there. But as Tom indicated, it's not the time to be jumping out, you know, either. And you don't want to miss those good days.
Yeah, we talk about the cautiously optimistic far too often, right? It's almost a trope at this point for investors like us to say we're cautiously optimistic. The reason for it is that short term, there's a lot of things to be cautious about. There's a lot of reasons why when you look at the war in Ukraine, when you look at the continued battle against inflation, when you look at an election season that's sure to bring some turmoil, those are all things that would cause you to go, okay, maybe next week looks a little different than this week does, and that might be bad news for stocks. But the optimism piece is the piece about, well, long-term stocks tend to mirror what earnings look like. Long-term, it seems like the market believes the Fed will win the fight against inflation when you look at long-term Treasury break-even inflation rates. So what is the market predicting inflation will look like 5, 10, even longer term years from now? It's back down around 2.4 to 2.5%, and that's close enough to the Fed's target that you know, I think the market believes they're going to win the battle. The market believes that inflation is really back on its way down. It might not be today. It might not be tomorrow. But all of this sets up nicely for some more certainty a year from now, 2 years from now, certainly as we look out. You know, I think we're the victim of kind of the latest news. We're the victim of kind of the latest challenges that are out there sometimes. And that's not a great way to invest. It's a great way to make sure you're taken care of. It's a great way to make sure that the next year, the next two are well planned for. It's why you talk about balance. It's why we talk about kind of that cautious piece. But long term, some reasons for optimism. You know, you kind of foreshadowed a bit of some conversation with Joel here. Joel, in particular, third quarter GDP released the first estimate for GDP. You know, we kept talking about this rule of thumb for whether or not we're in recession. You know, a reminder that it isn't strictly looking at gross domestic product to get an idea of whether we're in recession or not. And I think the third quarter, a great example of how things can quickly turn on the GDP front.
Yeah, Kyle, that's why we don't measure things that are important with our thumbs. So it's just a vague notion that if there are back-to-back quarters where the GDP has gone down, that that's a recession. Well, we've had the first two quarters of 2022 with the GDP going down, and now the third quarter, that first estimate shows GDP going up again. So it's sort of taking some of the notion away that we've already been in a recession. But it's actually interesting because it's fueling more speculation that we may be in one or we're about to be in one, because even though those numbers were positive, it showed 2.6% growth in the economy in the third quarter. There are things in the underlying numbers that show that the economy actually is weakening. We always talk about consumer spending. That's, you know, 70% of what drives the GDP. And that actually had gone down. It's decelerating now for the last five quarters. It's been going down and down. We had numbers today. Well, I'll get to the numbers today, but the GDP came out yesterday, and it showed that slowdown in consumer spending. It also showed what's going on in residential spending, and that's been down for six straight quarters. And there's where maybe we're seeing some of the effects of the Fed raising interest rates, because that's affecting mortgages. We had reports this week from the Commerce Department on new home sales. We had a report today from the National Association of Realtors on pending home sales. Those are all showing a downward trend, and both of those reports are citing the higher mortgage rates, that people aren't as interested in buying houses because they're not as affordable, and people aren't as interested in selling houses because they don't want to give up the low mortgage rates that they had, you know. I mean, we're looking at mortgage rates now in the 7% range. And that's about double what they were a year ago. So we're seeing that downward trend in consumer spending and in residential spending. There's an interesting table that the GDP report has where they look at the degree to which different factors affect the GDP rate. So that GDP, the percentage, annual percentage rate that it went up in the third quarter was 2.6%. But if you took out how much the residential spending pulled out of that report. If everything else being equal, if you took out residential, the GDP would have gone up 4% in those 3 months. So that was a big factor. So, you know, residential kind of, you know, really weighed that down. But so all that said, you know, we're expecting the spending to keep going slower. But we had the report today from the Commerce Department showing that consumer spending went up in September. So even though it's getting weaker, the consumers are still spending. And, you know, we can talk about this, but, I mean, the employment market is still pretty healthy. So that's sort of the thing that is fueling consumer spending more than anything, I think, is just the confidence that people have a job or they can get a job and that their wages are going to keep up.
Yeah, you know, I think consumption, the key driver of our economy, 70% of gross domestic product, and if you have a job, you can spend. If you have a job, you're going to spend, whether it's on the necessities or whether you can afford to spend a little more and get some of the wants, not just the needs. The labor market will be the piece that kind of continues to drive the economy going forward. It's why, despite, you know, some evidence that the Fed is causing a slowdown, despite some of the pain that Powell and the Fed has discussed, you know, it's why we are still so dialed into the labor market, because that's the piece that tells us, okay, how bad is it really going to get? If it gets bad, how bad is it really going to get? Well, the more people you have out of work, the less jobs you have for them to work, the more significant that impact is going to be. And so that's really what's left. The only other piece, and Joel, we got some news on kind of how consumers feel about things in some confidence data. You know, the only other piece here is inflation.
Right. Yeah. So the big number that came out of the GDP report was that the index that the Fed likes to look at for inflation was up 6.3% from the year before. So that's, you know, more than triple what their target is for long range inflation. They want it to be at 2%, and there it was at 6.3%. It's the same as it was. I'm sorry. So that was down though from you know, where it was in the second quarter. It was at 6.6% then, and it's actually the lowest it's been since the end of last year. So, you know, the trend there is good, that inflation is getting lower, but it's still really high. And the consumer surveys that you refer to are from the Conference Board and from the University of Michigan, and both of those show that inflation is again rising to put a kibosh on consumers' willingness to spend. Although, as I said, we're still seeing numbers that consumers are spending. And it's interesting because the Conference Board in their survey found that people actually, even though they're more concerned about inflation, that the plans to buy houses, to buy cars, to buy major appliances all rose from the last time they did the survey.
Yeah, it is amazing how much nuance there is in this data. It is amazing how you can look at a couple quarters of negative GDP growth and see labor as strong as it was, and then see a positive quarter of GDP growth and look at some of the reverse of that and go, yeah, but. And so I think, you know, a constant reminder for us that it isn't as simple as kind of that single talking point that so often the news media likes to portray as this is the thing that matters. It's a far more nuanced story. Art, maybe on that front, you know, we often talk about alternatives to cash, right? And I think the headlines have been that, you know, that cash is not all that great when you compare it to inflation. It's not all that great when you compare it to, you know, maybe what you could get historically. And yet there's a lot of alternatives for safer money out there.
Yeah, I'm going to give you credit for any number of times mentioning on this podcast the ability to get treasuries, one-year treasuries, you know, paying 4%. Those rates might have gone down a little, you know, this week, but I mean, it's a bond, it's an alternative to cash, and it's very, very safe. And I've taken advantage of that opportunity, you know, thanks to your suggestion. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal this week talking about brokered CDs versus what the local banks are offering, paying significantly more, and we have access to those, you know. So if someone wants something safe, really safe, you can put your money in a CD, which is cash, paying, I think, a decent rate. Another one is, and we've talked about this before, this is the last day. So depending on when you listen to this podcast, you may or may not have an opportunity to buy I-bonds from Treasury Direct, the government site. 28th of October, for the record here, is the last date they're allowing purchases at that rate. Now, the new rate's going to be, I think, under 7. It's still a decent rate, but their systems are getting just blown out. There's so much demand this week. I think they sold more maybe this week than they sold all of last year or something in these I-bonds statistics or something like that. So there are safe places to put money, not to play down what we do here, which is developing balanced portfolios that make money over long periods of time. This is a rare exception this year. You know, bear markets are few and far between. In the 31 years I've been here, there's only been 4 major bear markets that I can point to, and this is one of the most annoying ones. Just because of the way it keeps going and going. It's like the Energizer Bunny. And I don't see it necessarily ending anytime
soon. That's
a
boomer reference, I think.
It is. Yeah. So for your for cash or you know, short-term treasuries, CDs, and I-bonds, if you can get through today.
Well, the Gen Z version of the Energizer Bunny will probably be it keeps going and going like a Tesla or some kind of rechargeable battery, I would imagine. But yeah, I think, you know, a reminder that there isn't a need to always have all of your money invested. There is a reason why you have cash. There's a reason why you have specific maturities, whether it's a CD or a treasury bond with kind of a nearer term maturity. They fit specific objectives. And so sometimes separating the idea of this is my 3, 4, 5 year money from this is my next year money is a helpful exercise to try to overcome some of the fear that comes from this market volatility. You know, mentioned how annoying this market has been. It's annoying not just because of the persistence of it, but also because it's been stocks and bonds. It's a reminder that you need a wider selection of tools than just, you know, the 1 or 2 stocks or bonds. You know, it's a bigger shopping list than that, and you get to pick from more than just those 2 things. So I think a good reminder as you kind of look at what's available out there that, yeah, you might not be able to get that I-bond from the Treasury, given that their website's pretty tied up this afternoon. But there are alternatives out there for money that you want to keep safe, for money that you know you're going to need at the end of the year, sometime next year. And those are all important conversations to have with your advisor so that we can get an understanding for how we help you navigate that. Well, thank you all for listening. We enjoy doing the show for you. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.